accession number 10170, reel number 8.
Mr. Walter Spencer, reel 8. You were telling me about the ground conditions at Ypres and the problem that mules had, some mules had. Did you have to be careful yourself not to fall in such shell holes?
Oh, yes. And you see, particularly at night time, because you, when you got off the what they call the duck boards, you used to walk on wooden duck boards, you know, on the main road. Well, particularly when the duck boards were not there, you couldn't see where the shell holes were. So you got full of mud, so... The leading men used to go up in single file. He was the leading man saying, mind that post or mind that hole, you see, as you're going along.
Did you ever fall in any deep mud yourself?
Oh, yes, several times. You couldn't avoid it. Perhaps you're going up to your knees, you see, with an ordinary shell hole, or even up to your thighs, but you'd get out again, of course, everybody else would laugh, and that would be it.
And is there anything else you remember about the fighting at Passchendaele? Did you have to make any attacks there?
We were in the main attack, actually. And
what can you remember about that?
Well, I can remember that the trenches that we occupied were very, very bad. There wasn't sufficient cover, and that was the big trouble, you see. If Jerry either advanced or retired, you couldn't occupy his old trenches. I said that'd be your objective, you see, to get into the drive them out and get them into their trench, use their earthworks as protection for yourselves. Passchendaele, as I said, was very bad because he held the high ground and he could do so much damage with his machine guns. Because in my opinion, machine guns were the principal thing during the war. You could have all your bombs and artillery fire and all that thing, shrapnel, but the machine guns were the things that mowed most people down and caused most casualties. And unfortunately, when we started as a battalion, we had two machine guns to a battalion. And later on, we had 16 to a battalion. We finished up with 32 to a battalion. Toward the end of the war. That was later on, some would talk about 1917 time, but at the beginning, 1915 and 16, there were only two machine guns to a battalion.
Now, at Passchendaele, were you still, what rank were you holding by then, 1917?
I was a private. I was private all my soldiering.
Because you became a gas, you became something to do with gas, a gas instructor or gas.
Oh yes, gas. I was anti-gas man, as they call me, yes, anti-gas instructor, really.
Was that while you were at Ypres?
Yes, that was early than the first attack at Ypres. Yeah.
Can you tell me about your job? What your job was?
Well, the chief thing I had to do was to detect gas. Let's know the different smells of different gases it's overused, you see.
How were you trained in that?
You got to know that chlorine was made of chloride of lime, you see, and you get all your knowledge from the different casualties. We used to get gas casualties, of course. There was tear gases, nose gases, and of course there were blister gases later. Mustard gas was the blistered gas, and that was very, very bad, because if it landed anywhere, you'd get a blister, and often blister gases were fatal.
The others usually weren't, then? You didn't feel the others usually were fatal?
Oh, no.
You'd have to have a very large dose of, say, chlorine to...
It depends upon how the cloud travelled. With gas, it's a peculiar thing. Now, wind from 5 to 12 miles an hour were suitable for the travel of any gas, you see, and it would come along as a cloud, you see, impelled by the wind, of course. But if the wind was higher than that, it wouldn't be so fatal because it'd disperse it quicker. And the wind, if it was less than 5, we'd practically no wind at all. It'd hover around your own trenches and cause your own people casualties.
Now, you were still anti-gas man, I presume, in 1917.
Oh, yes, right through the war.
How did they try and counteract the blister gases, as you say, the mustard gas?
Well, they had, for a start, they had what they called decontamination centres, where they treated blister gas casualties only. But if they didn't get in time, I should say that easily 75% of the people who got mustard gas, it wasn't used extensively, by the way, but when it was used, 75% of those who had much mustard gas would die. It would be fatal.
What were the causes of death, the symptoms? Why was it fatal?
Well, because it not only burnt, but it if you inhaled it, the vapour from it, that was fatal to your lungs.
What about the other gases? What precautions did you introduce in the field for the other gases and for mustard gas? What did you tell people to do and not to do?
Well, you couldn't do much as far as mustard gas is concerned because you'd require a special suit of clothing, see? Because the whole of the body would be affected. And although I only had one instance where the Germans did use mustard gas, but it wasn't generally used.
Do you remember that? What do you remember about that incident? Can you remember that time when the Germans did use it?
Yes. It was a day when it was a pouring day, and that was the worst time they could have used it, really, because it wasn't so efficient as it was when it was dry, you see, mustard gas. There were different symptoms altogether. The chief gas that was used was chlorine, chloride of lime gas, chlorine. And if you inhale that, of course, your lungs swelled up and they couldn't take any air, and you died of choking, as you might say. There was another choking gas called phosgene. You see, I learned a lot about this previous to going out, this gas business, from the gas school.
Right. Before, one thing that you wanted to tell me about, and which I think we should do, is the story of the Easter Day church service. When you were hit by a shell. Do you want to tell that story now?
Yes, we were at that time. We were at 107 camp at Elverdinge. Elverdinge was near to Poppering, and we paraded there and went to gas service on Easter Sunday morning. And about halfway through the service, Jerry shoved a 12-inch shell about halfway through the hut in length, and it blew a portion of the hut right up and caused an immense number of casualties. I don't know exactly, to be truthful, how many casualties there were, but there'd be well over 50 casualties. And we had to help, we who were not affected by it, had to help dig them out and get them out and get them in hospital.
What was your state of mind when that happened?
We were really shocked, you know what I mean, because the impact of a 12-inch shell coming anywhere near you within say 50 yards would be enormous.
So, well, what do you remember after Passchendaele and Third Ypres, moving into 1918?
We're coming now to... Well, we've got over Levante, haven't we? We've been to Levante. Next part of the line... You see, I've got to try and recollect these things of about 40, 50 years ago, which aren't but easy to dig up.
Do you remember where your battalion was during the German attacks after February, March 1918?
Yes, we were at a place called Nieppe Forest, and we went down there really to reinforce Portuguese division, which had been got up in Portugal and sent on the Allies' side, and they didn't know where to put them, and they put them almost at the end of the line at this place in the Nieppe Forest. Well, when the Germans first started to bombard, all the Portuguese ran away, and that finished them. We happened to be in reserve to them, and we went up, and we had to keep the line intact if we could, and it was a rather tricky situation altogether, because there were no artillery supporting us. You see, they'd got their own artillery, they took that back. That was about the only time I ever saw troops really actually running away from the line, but fortunately they were not British.
What do you remember about that action? Do you remember much more about it?
Well, I only know this, that we did succeed in stopping them for so long, and they counterattacked and reinforced, and they did get through eventually. Although we'd done our best, we were there, I think, about 4 or 5 days, and they got through just on our right. Of course, they were travelling very rapidly then. They weren't even digging in. They'd got troops on the move.
But where was the force? Where were you?
Where
was your battalion? Were you involved in the retreat, or were you elsewhere?
We were reinforced, and then we were taken out of the line because we were there 5 days, and we went back, and subsequently, when we were in reserve, they broke through the second time. They had two attacks there. I'm trying to think of the name of the attack that they called. It was a proper name to it, wasn't there, in 1918, when they generally broke through a long way.
Doesn't matter. I can't. Funnily enough, I can't quite remember it just at the moment either.
Yeah.
So, what did the battalion do then? How were you involved in the subsequent fighting after you'd been relieved? Where did you go then?
After we'd been relieved, we went back to somewhere near Mons, and we were there resting when the armistice was signed.
Ah, there's a bit of a jump there. So you weren't really involved in the counterattacks against the German at breakthrough?
No, because we were relieved by somebody else. I forget that it would be another infantry battalion came and relieved us, and we went back, you see, after we'd been
You weren't any more involved in the offensives against the Germans?
No, that's right. That was about the last one we had, real attack. We held the line in different places, but no attacks, you see.
I see. Did you get any leave home during your service?
Yes. I got leave in 1916, 17 and 18. Now, the one at 1918 is very dear to me because I left the battalion and got down to Boulogne early, 6 o'clock on November the 11th, the day armistice was declared. And their boat sailed at 11 a.m., and just before the boat sailed came a runner down to the officer in charge of the... They always had an officer in charge of a leaf boat, you see, and told him that an armistice had been declared, and he got up and told us all, and a lot of cheering, and everybody booed him and said it was a put-up, you see. No, nobody would believe it, let's put it that way. Although the sirens were all booming round at Boulogne, you know, when we were in train. Anyhow, we finally got over to England, to Folkestone, and it was confirmed there.
You didn't believe it either, then?
Oh, no, I didn't believe it. Nobody believed it. They think, you're kidding us, you see. Well, when we got over to Folkestone, there were flags out and people about everywhere, and we began to believe it then, that it was true. Anyway, we got on the train for London and we got to Victoria Station. There were thousands in Victoria Station. We could hardly move when the train came and everybody's gone mad there, you know, dancing in the streets and all the pubs were open, there were booze and that kind of thing. Anyhow, I was pleased to get out of it. I did happen to get a bus and got straight across to Marylebone and got a train at 3:30, I remember, and come up to Nottingham and got home 6 o'clock that night. So I always remember November the 11th.
Your family had moved.
My family had during the war, my father had got employment up here, and he'd finished down there. They went up around about here, actually, just
Carlton,
yes. So I had to go back, unfortunately, although my leave expired, you know, my leave expired, I made my way to Chelsea Barracks, and I was to present myself and said I'd come there because I was on leave from France. So the officer said, well, if you're on leave from France, you'll have to go back to France, go back to your unit and rejoin there. So I went back again and rejoined our unit just in time for the march up to Germany. And we marched from up this place just near Mons right up to Cologne. That was over 200 miles in about, I think it took 12 days on continuous marching.
What sort of reception were you getting from the public, the civilians, as you marched through?
You mean the German civilians?
Well, and the Belgians Germany.
Well, the Belgians warmly welcomed us. Of course, we got some very good times. Our first stop, practically, I think, was in Belgium, because we were up at that end, and the Belgians give us a good time, and the Dutch, we had a good reception from them as we went through Holland. And
you went through Holland?
Yes, the bottom end of Holland. Actually, we went over the borders in Aachen. Achterpallet was called then, Aachen. That was the place where we went over the border. One episode there I remember, actually at Aachen, because we had a rest there, a night. We used to spend the night in barns, you see, or anywhere like that. They were around. They used to accommodate us when we were on the march. And we all got down, our company, into a big barn, farm barn, and we had to carry candles in a tin, you know, to light us at night to get down. And of course, there was all straw in the barn, and we'd all lit our candles and sat all around, and someone got to bed, and the old farmer came in and looked at us and switched on the electric light, and the light lit the whole barn up. Of course, we gave him a loud cheer. Anyhow, he and his wife, the Germans, of course, they made a great big 2-gallon thing full of soup, stew, and brought to us hot, and we had a darn good feed from them. That was from Germans, and we'd been killing them, they'd been killing us 2 or 3 days before. That's curious, isn't it?
So was that typical of your reception from the German civilians?
Oh, yes.
Yes,
of course, the Germans were very subdued, actually, because when we went over the border from Aachen, we say, on the way to Cologne, there were musters of people watching us going by, and some of them even cheering us. So they weren't anti, of course. They were really for us. One amusing incident was the fact that when we got to Cologne, they'd got the guards, the Grenadiers military band there, and we marched through in triumph, and the sergeant major detailed 4 men to each side to go in front of the battalion, and they had the colours flying, you see, they sent the colours out from London, and everybody who had a hat on who didn't salute the colours, the sergeant major ordered them to knock the hats off, and the bowler hats and caps and hats running all over the street, you know, and then you pointed the colours, you see, as much as say you've got to respect them. They didn't understand that little bit of it, but it was very amusing to see the Jerry's hats flying over the street. We had quite a good time in Cologne, really.
Were we billeted in Cologne, or accommodated, rather?
Actually, our section was in the fire station. There's a big fire station there. They had a big long room, and we were billeted there. December the 12th, I think it was, we arrived in Cologne. And we were there over Christmas, and actually till...
What were you actually doing there? I mean, were you training or just
parading?
Oh,
no, we didn't do much, except for what we call cleaning up parades. We always had to parade once a day, you see, the battalion did, and we had to clean our buttons and everything, rifles and everything, and look spick and span, you see, before we went out. We were allowed out then into the town, so we saw quite a lot of Cologne. but there was nobody ever hostile to us, and they were very, as I say, subdued and quite decent. Well, we got sorry for them because we realised that their civilians had a lot tougher time than our own civilians during the war. They hadn't seen chocolate since the war started. They got no tobacco and very, very little bread. And the bread they had was coloured. It was more black than white, we used to call it. Rye bread it was. The only food they had was the necessaries of life. You couldn't say they had anything extravagant in the way of cakes, anything like that. And they told us that's all they'd had in their rations since the war started. And, of course, the majority of them gave us the impression that they didn't want war. Well, we realised they were like us. We didn't want war and they didn't want war. But it was the warlords, the Nazi party, who had compelled all their people to go to war, of course.
Well, not the Nazis then. Not the Nazi party then.
What? Not...
It wouldn't have been the Nazi party then. They hadn't been formed. You mean the Kaiser?
Yes, that's right. It was the powers that be were said had ordered the war, all the big warlords who wanted the war, but not them. But I got on very, very well with the Germans, although we didn't speak German, and a lot of them could speak English, curiously enough.
Did you notice any signs of political unrest while you were in Cologne?
Unrest? No.
Political unrest, I mean amongst the Germans,
No. Actually, our battalion, the 4th Battalion, was disbanded in Cologne and went home. I stayed on in the Army of Occupation until February, about a month.
Who did you stay with?
Stayed at the billet where I was at. There were a section of us, roughly speaking, I should say, to be 40 or 50, who stayed together and had an officer in command, that kind of thing. We used to go and patrol the streets at night time in pairs, you see, just to kind of preserve order. But we never had any trouble, slightest trouble. And if you told a German to get off, you know, even if you were drunk or anything like that, he'd go. He wouldn't question you. I really enjoyed my stay in Cologne. We used to go every Sunday there. We used to march to the cathedral and have church service there. And one of our chaps used to play the organ there out of the battalion. He had been an organist, apparently a church organist in England, and he used to take the service.
What recreations would you have? Same as usual? Or?
Oh, we went to the cinemas and all that. We could go to the State Opera House, and of course we always went in free. We never paid anywhere, but we used to get a posh seat in the Opera House. I used to go there. They used to change the opera once a week. It was a state thing altogether, and a state orchestra, and that was a very good performance. We used to be regular attenders there, and we used to go down to Bonn on the tram, the town of Bonn, and that was a very nice town. We used to go down on a Sunday afternoon on the boat on the Rhine. But I could have stayed in Cologne for 2 or 3 years, as far as I was concerned.
Was there any black market operating? Was there any temptation to sell army food? Not in large quantities, but...
Yes, now the only thing I knew about that is that some chaps were receiving packets of cigarettes from England and selling them to the Germans, but that was stopped. And it was a punishable offence if you were caught at it. You see, the Red Caps used to control all that kind of thing. That was the only black market that I knew about. Although, of course, the females were always after chocolate and all that kind of thing. They get it from the soldiers. But that wasn't encouraged, because it encouraged other things besides that. It encouraged immorality. So that they stopped the troops doing that.
Now, why was that section retained? Your section retained?
Why
did they stay on it for an extra period?
Well, because it was a matter of volunteering. If they hadn't got a job to go to in civil life when they got discharged from the army, when they were virtually discharged, you see, directly they went to England, and demobbed, well, they thought, well, might as well hang on here and have a month so of this and get paid for it.
So, in February, that was the end of it, was it?
Yes, that's right. That's when it was taken over by the different control. But I really did enjoy Cologne, and it was a very nice city too, what there was left of it. Of course, it had been bombed. We'd put a few bombs very, very close to the cathedral too.
In the First World War?
In the First World War, they were after, actually, the object of it was Hohenzollern Bridge, which went over the Rhine at Cologne. That's what they had to get. I should have said the artillery firing. It wasn't airplane bombs.
So, what happened when you in February when you left Cologne? Where did you? How was it all organised? And how were you demobilised?
Oh, we all came to England. I went to the Tower of London actually, and I was at the Tower of London until March, I think, about a fortnight out at the Tower of London, doing no parades or anything like that. And then I was finally demobilised.
Did you want to be demobilised, or would you have liked to have stayed in the army? Did it ever occur to you to become a regular?
No, I'd had enough, and I wanted to get out as soon as I could when I got to England. I'd made application for the police force. I joined the police force on May the 15th, after I'd had a little spot of army leave. I was in the police force in 1945. That's me up there.
You went straight into steady employment. But how had the war affected you mentally and physically, do you think?
Well, I suppose really I was relieved that there was no war on, and I felt free and easy, that kind of thing. But I don't think I had any physical harm through the war, although I might attribute this deafness perhaps to the sound of guns and that kind of thing. They told me that at the hospital, by the way. It might have affected the drums of the ear, you see. And I'm getting it now later on in life. Unfortunately, I get no disability pension for it, but still, I'm not bothered.
The war didn't leave you nervous or edgy or anything?
Oh, no. I was quite... I bore up all right. I didn't...
Did you think it had all been worthwhile? Would you have joined up again?
Well, I've often asked myself the question. I think patriotism was the main thing. And you see, all these young chaps who joined Kitchener's Army, I was very sorry for them because they were so patriotic and wanted to get going, and they really got out there before the time when they weren't properly trained. The consequence was they went in on July the 1st, new troops, 1916, and ran right under fire, didn't know what to do or anything like that, and they were just mown down. See, the longer you were out there, you got more trench experience, and you learnt to keep your head down and take advantage of all the cover you could.
But was it all worthwhile? That's what I'm really...
Oh, yes. Yes, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't have done the other. I wouldn't like to have funked it. No, I wouldn't be a conscientious objector. I was patriotic to know that the country was at war, and I went there to do my bit.